It is indeed a pleasure for me to be speaking today on this webinar arranged by the Medina Institute of Leadership and Entrepreneurship. As you guys must have read from the background of this topic, we're going to be talking about something that is of great interest to almost anyone. You know, as the world is suffering from one of its worst financial crises, you know, there's a lot of talk since the last 2-3 years about why this has happened, who's to blame, what impact it's going to have, is it being resolved as yet or not. And there's a lot of discussion on a variety of aspects relating to this crisis, but it seems to me that very few seem to be focusing on some of the very fundamental flaws in the global financial system. And amongst these basic flaws lies a very basic like the ABC of finance, but it's unfortunately either very rarely talked about or it's not adequately discussed, or perhaps even if it is, it's quite often very severely misunderstood. And I'm talking about one of these very basic laws, which is relating to money issuance. It might sound very simple, it might even sound too basic as to what do you mean by money issuance and what's the problem with that. But once you go through this session, hopefully you'll be able to understand some of the fundamental concepts that are often not talked about and therefore misunderstood. And therefore, it will enable you to understand the root causes of a variety of problems in our financial system which has led to this crisis. And I'm not talking about some of the peripheral or, you know, the problems in the later stages. You know, we're talking about really basic foundations. It's quite interesting that how sometimes we end up ignoring some of the very basic aspects and start concentrating on some of the more complicated aspects that occur later in the process. I hope you can all see the screen of my my presentation. I'll move on to the next slide.
I think you can move to the next slide. It is working fine.
Yes. It's important to remember that the global financial system, you know, forms the backbone of our world. It's not something that is an isolated thing that, you know, that involves just a few people or a few organizations. It affects all, each one of us, whether through our jobs or whether through our industry or our organizations. It also has a strong connection and nexus with our political and social systems. But unfortunately, most people know about bits and pieces of the system at best, and the understanding of the overall system tends to be quite low. Even I've experienced in my career that a lot of people, even in the financial system itself, who are working in the financial system, often get too bogged down by their specializations and just don't seem to connect the overall pieces of the system to understand what's going on. Post the financial crisis, a lot of blame game has also happened. You know, a lot of finger pointing has been done as, you know, this happened because, you know, the bankers were doing it, the, you know, the regulations were not enough, there was too much greed in the system, so on and so forth. But, you know, I believe that in some ways we all are involved, either directly or indirectly, because we're all part of the system, you know, and our ignorance about the basic issues is not really an excuse. You know, ignorance, I think, is not really bliss. And therefore, we all need to spend some time and analyze the fundamentals and foundations of the system so that we are better able to understand the problems that are associated with it and play our own role, small or big, in hopefully correcting these problems for a better future for ourselves and for our next generations. Just to give you a little idea, just moving on to the next slide. You know, I often ask these questions that you can see on this slide to lots of people that I've presented similar presentations, whether they do know the answers to these very basic questions, which I'll just sort of read out, because you can only see that. What does your currency node say exactly? And very often, I don't even have to move on to the next question, and so far, to the large number of people that I have presented to in the last many years, I've seldom ever received the correct answer. You know, what does the note say? What does it mean? Who even prints currency notes in your country, and on what basis? Are questions that many of us realize that we do not know the answer, and that kind of reflects that this piece of paper that we carry in our wallets and hold so dearly, how little we really know about it. And let me ask you a question. You know, one of the most important currencies in the world is the US dollar. And ask yourself this question, do you know what it really says on it? There's quite a few things written on it. When I ask this question, I often get the answer that it says, "In God we trust." That's right, that's probably written on the, you know, on the back side of the note, but what it really says, and what is more meaningful, is something else, and that's written in a bit of a fine print. And I've just sort of displayed a US dollar note, $100 bill, in front of you, front side and the back side, and you will see "In God we trust" written in bold letters at the back. But what is really of more interest is this particular statement over here that I'm highlighting. And I'll just, for your convenience, I will enlarge it further in the next slide, just for you to see what it really says. Now, in case you haven't read this so far, you have it there right in front of you. Hopefully, when somebody asks you this question next time around, you'll be better equipped. It says, "This note is legal tender for all debts, public and private, and signed by the Treasurer of the United States." That's all very good. You know, now you know what it says, but you know, can you really tell what it really means? You know, "This note is legal tender for all debts, public and private." Don't be sort of shy or embarrassed if you realize that you've never read it and you never understood it, or even if you have read it now and still don't get it, because this is really just to demonstrate that most of us don't really have the basic essence of where money comes from, why it's issued, and what it really means. Let me ask you another question. This is what we were talking about. The US dollar. Let's talk about the pound, because that statement is somewhat even more confusing, if not funny to say. Now, this is the picture of a British pound, the front side and the back side, and there's some things scribbled on it on various parts. And again, so far I've never got the right answer from many people that I've asked this question as to what does this one say. And this is something that's written on this part that I'm highlighting, which really needs to be read and perhaps understood. I'll make it easier for you, and so you can see what it's written. It says, "I promise to pay the bearer on demand the sum of £10." Very interesting, right? £10 of what? It's a very strong statement, but you know, it's quite interesting to note that it really doesn't mean much anymore. But there's obviously a history and background behind it, and that's what we're going to try to understand as we go along the presentation. Similar example for the Pakistani rupee. It's basically an Urdu language, but it really says, and I'll highlight it again for you. It's just basically an Urdu translation of whatever was written on the pound. It says, "The State Bank of Pakistan promises to pay on demand the bearer of this note 1,000 rupees." And you know, one would really want to question then, what is this then? If this is not 1,000 rupees, what's the bearer of the note we would get from the State Bank of Pakistan? Anyway, this was just to demonstrate the fact that these pieces of paper that we hold so dearly and that we use all the time, we most of us do not really have a true concept of what they're all about. So therefore, I'm going to move on and go and try and understand and try and explain the very basic concept of money. And this is an extremely important part. And the next few slides that I'm going to talk about may sound a bit very basic, but I think once you get the gist of what these very objects are. This can be extremely helpful in understanding the basic concept of money, removing any misconceptions, as well as understanding the root causes of the problems that are happening because of the lack of compliance with some of the basic requirements. To reiterate the concept of money and to say, maybe stating the obvious, but actually it's not as obvious when you realize that we're not really complying with it. Why do we need money? You know, you might say that's very obvious, we need to buy things, but effectively we need money to have a common unit to measure the prices of goods and services, and therefore use physical or electronic representations of that unit to exchange goods and services. Now, it's very important to remember that money in itself has no intrinsic utility. It is only created as a medium of exchange and as a measure of value. And the money notes or whatever coins or pages that you use, it's a means to achieve a certain objective, which is the purchase of goods and services. And money itself is not the objective, right? So therefore, money's eventual purpose is only the exchange of goods and services. Now, this is an extremely important concept to remember because somehow the concept has become distorted over a period of time and we seem to make money itself the purpose and not the eventual purpose for what it's built for. Now, let me explain this concept of how money comes in and just for you to be able to understand the very basic concept afterwards. I'm going to give a very simple, very basic example, but it's hopefully going to clarify the concept very well. Let's assume that there's a person A who produces apples and there's a person B who produces oranges. And assume that both A and B perceive the price of an apple equal to the price of an orange. Now, if A wants to buy an orange and B wants to buy an apple, then they can simply exchange the items without the need for money, right? So A can give the orange, the apple to B, and B can just give him the orange. Now, this is known as a double coincidence of needs, that, you know, one person needs what the other person has and vice versa, and it's a similar value to both things, and therefore they can exchange it without the need for money. This is essentially barter in many ways. It's not really a common occurrence. You will, generally speaking, it's very difficult to find people who will want to buy what you have and vice versa and have similar values. Therefore, let's take a step forward and assume that the same situation, A produces apples, B produces oranges, and we have a third person, person C, who produces strawberries. Now let's say A wants oranges, B wants strawberries, and C wants apples. Now the situation is a bit more complicated than the first situation. And assuming they all perceive the price of each of these things to be similar, then what will happen is A can buy the orange from B and give him A what is called a promissory note or a piece of paper or an IOU stating that I owe you an apple. You know, like I'm buying the orange from you, but I owe you an apple, which you don't really want at the moment. B can take that IOU from A, give it to person C, and buy a strawberry for him from him. And C will use that IOU to buy an apple from A. Now, it sounds very simple, but this is where money gets created. This IOU that was given by person A to B, this IOU is money. It was needed at the time because somebody wanted to buy something from another person but did not have something to give him at that point in time which was wanted by the other person, and therefore it was like a promissory note or a little debt that it issued because he did produce something that was required maybe by somebody else. Now, this is an extremely, extremely important concept, no matter how simple it sounds, to remember that this IOU represents money. And therefore, expanding the concept further, money represents the price of actual goods or services and is or should be created in proportion to the production of goods and services and also the transactions for their exchange. So, as in the previous example, money would not have been required if A, B, and C did not want to buy each other's goods and they were just happy with having their own goods themselves. Now, if In the above simplistic example, just to keep it simple and to understand the concept, assuming the economy consisted of just apples, oranges, and strawberries, the maximum amount of money that could be ethically there at any point is the sum total of the value of all the apples, oranges, and strawberries. And this is an extremely important concept to remember. And just think of the situation that if I or use our money more than the worth of the actual goods or issue, then you can understand by the previous example that somebody would lose in the end and someone would gain at the expense of the loser. So if you had just one apple, one orange, and one strawberry, and instead of having just three pieces of paper or three notes which represented those assets to exchange the goods, somebody came up with a fourth piece of paper, that would be unethical because eventually it will not lead to buying any goods or services. In fact, it would end up being wasted and create a loss for some of them. Now, moving on to with this foundation of the concept of money that I've just spoken about, it's important to remember that to avoid the risk associated with a potential IOU, for example, a person A refuses to honor his IOU, historically gold or silver was used in money. And this essentially continued the practice of barter, but against a common good, i.e. gold or silver, which somehow everyone seemed to want. What happened was that it's extremely important to remember that gold and silver has been historically used as money for the following four reasons. And if you were to remember these four reasons or put them with you as something to remember forever, it's extremely important because that can further clarify the concept of money. The reason gold or silver was used as money was because these commodities were easily standardized into divisible units globally. You know, gold was gold in New York, gold is gold in Riyadh, gold is gold in London. And therefore, it's not something that anybody can just issue out of nowhere. It is a standardized commodity, and it can also be divided into standardized units, into, you know, 1 shilling, 2 shilling, or 1 ounce, 2 ounce, whatever. The other aspect that's very important about gold and silver was that they could be easily stored, and they do not perish easily, and therefore can be accounted for. Now, there were no computers historically, so therefore you needed to account for money, you needed to measure them, and therefore these commodities and their standardized units serve as a reliable way for accounting this money. And it also helped, as in item C that I'm going to explain, that gold or silver for some reason had a perceived value as wealth itself. Even if you look at it, they don't have much utility other than some ornamental value. But because people and humanity in history has always perceived gold and silver or other commodities to have some value, they would use these commodities like barter against a common item. So instead of having various different IOUs, you had a common item which everybody wanted, so you priced everything in its turn. And finally, it was extremely important, an aspect was that gold or silver could not be created out of nowhere. They were not like pieces of paper which anybody could just print out. So therefore, the combination of these four elements made gold or silver to be an important aspect that made them money itself. Now, where did paper currency come from? I'll move on to the next slide. Now, what happened was it was extremely inconvenient to carry gold and silver. And I'm talking about now a history of money from a conceptual point of view, just very basic. I'll go to some of the actual historical milestones when you will see, is that to avoid the carrying or transportation of the gold and silver for purchasing large assets in far-off locations, paper currency was created because they became receipts for the actual gold and silver. So they, some custodians like goldsmiths or the people, they said, you keep the gold and silver with us, we issue you a receipt or a promissory note stating you can come and collect this gold or silver anytime you want. And now you could use this receipt, which was then called paper currency, to buy goods and services. It was based on the fact that the holder of that note could come back and collect his gold or silver anytime he or she wanted. Now, this was a very, very important aspect. But what happened in history always is that over a period of time, the custodian, which was from current point of view, was the equivalent of a central bank, it did two unethical acts so as to earn unjustified money itself. The first unethical act that it did was that it issued notes without any asset as it signed the receipts for now as good as the assets. The guy realized that, you know, these guys would never come to collect their acts of gold and silver, so the custodian would just simply issue extra notes without the backing of the gold to buy goods and services himself, which was obviously an unethical and a dishonest act. The other thing that was conceptually done, that because all this gold and silver started lying around in safe places and they were not actually being utilized, the custodian started lending other people's gold and silver to other people at an interest. Now, both these unethical acts were based on the assumption or a bet that not more than a certain percentage of these note holders or depositors will want their assets back at the same time, right? So every time this percentage breached, the custodian failed. People would start doubting as to why the custodian is becoming so late. So they would come back and ask for the gold. Person, one person came, second person came. By the time the third or the fourth person would come or more, the custodian actually didn't have the gold and silver because it had lent out to somewhere else or the notes were just not fair. Now, does this sound familiar? This is, you might think that this is sounding very familiar, and you're very right, because the current system has actually institutionalized these two main unethical acts, unfortunately, which is that the notes are actually without wealth, and there's, you know, on lending with interest. There's both these two fundamental problems are currently the basis of our financial system, very, very unfortunately. And, you know, and to pacify depositors, they're also given an interest rate on the deposit, which is generally much less than the comparative rates charged to borrowers. And now, with the advent of electronic money, the problem is further exacerbated because electronic money is just digits on your computer screen and they can be created literally at the flick of a button. Now, I'll run you through in the next few slides the actual historical milestones as to how we've gotten to these problems. But the bottom line is that money used to represent value on a formal basis for its issuance is now no longer the case since the last 40 years. And paper seems to have just turned into wealth itself, and it's all about currency notes, treasury bills, bonds, without any formal linkage to real assets or to production of goods and services. I'm going to quickly run you through, you know, this is in the next slide, you know, you can see the transition of what has happened historically in the history of money. You had barter historically, then you moved on to coins, which was gold or silver, then you moved on to paper currency, which was effectively just a receipt for those coins, then you established a gold standard, then you established fractional reserves, which were currently partially backed by gold, and eventually you moved on to what is now called fiat currency, i.e. that there is no standard for the currency at all. And just to explain to you how we got to this unfortunate situation is I will quickly run you through the historical milestones. I'm not going to read out most of it to you, but effectively you can go through these points and realize that I'm not just talking about very conceptually, or it's not a story, it's actually how it really happened. So effectively, as you can see, paper currency began its existence in Europe when the goldsmiths issued receipts for the coins. And generally, goldsmiths were supposed to honor their receipts. But when goldsmiths started creating fake receipts and also became money lenders, this combination became a bank. And the owners of these banks became very unduly wealthy and powerful. And so naturally speaking, a lot of multiple bank failures occurred. And by the beginning of the 18th century, beginning with England, the governments declared themselves the sole authority to issue currency notes. And therefore, the paper currency was backed by the central bank. And now you can see why, when you look back at the British pound, for example, that we saw, it actually used to say at one point that I promised to pay the bearer in demand a sum of 20 shillings of gold or whatever. Individual citizens could actually go to the central bank window and actually claim their gold against those notes. And unfortunately, that language has been dropped now, as you will see once we progress down history. By 1815, all currencies of the world were either based on gold or silver. By the end of the 19th century, gold replaced silver, in all the major trading countries. And this readily convertible fixed ratio gold currency relationship, along with the private citizen's right to freely hold and import gold, became known as the gold standard. And between 1880 and 1914, this standard prevailed on a global scale, and there were significant benefits of price and exchange rate stability with minimal risk of capital loss. However, between the two world wars, unfortunately, the violation of the gold standard's basic condition were done. This resulted in devaluations, restrictions, and suspensions. And by the mid-30s, almost all countries had broken the link between gold and currency. In 1945, 40 countries signed the Bretton Woods Agreement, which basically said that the value of the US dollar will now be fixed to a certain weight of gold, which was at that time 135 ounces, and the value of all other currencies would be fixed in terms of the US dollar. So literally, the process was the same. It moved on from goldsmiths to central banks, and the central banks moved on to one central bank of the United States. And the US government guaranteed to maintain this ratio, and all countries promised to peg their currencies with the dollar. And now individual citizens could not go to their own central banks and actually ask for gold and silver, but each central bank of every country could go to the US central bank window and claim their gold. But guess what happened? You know, just like the goldsmiths and just like the central banks of individual countries, unfortunately, the US did the same thing. And by the end of 1970, the US dollar claims of foreigners have become more than twice the gold reserves. And finally, in 1971, August 15th to be precise, the Bretton Woods Agreement was disbanded and the link of the US dollar with the gold was disbanded. And now the US dollar, and same as the case with other currencies, they float freely, i.e. that there is actually no formal linkage to any asset whatsoever or any basis. And governments and central banks now have total discretion since the last 40 years on the amount of currency that can be printed without any formal discipline. And therefore, as you can very well imagine, inflation happens, inflation goes uncontrolled. And inflation, in my opinion, through this way, this unnatural way, is basically, in many ways, confiscation of wealth because it destroys your buying power. And you'd be surprised, if, in case you're also one of them, but I've realized that there are a great, significant majority of people in the world somehow still think, not rightly so, that most of the currencies of the world probably are still backed by some commodity, namely gold. But it's actually quite shocking news to most people that there is actually no basis since the last 40 years. Now, let's revisit the concept of money based on the history that I've just said. I reiterate that, you know, money itself has no intrinsic utility. It's only created to achieve a certain objective, which is purchase of goods and services. And other than ornamental value, really gold or silver doesn't really have, you know, any other use, but they were used as money because of the three, four reasons that I talked about earlier. But what is important to remember is that it is not necessary to have gold or silver as money. If you remember the very simple example of the three people, A, B, and C, that I mentioned who were trying to sell some goods as simple as apple, oranges, and strawberries, there was no gold and silver involved in those transactions. What you need to do is that the three or four conditions that we mentioned that made gold or silver as money, you can somehow have the same conditions for anything that can act as money. Therefore, the conclusion that you draw from that situation is that what is necessary is that whatever is declared as money or currency by an economy is issued by a reliable and auditable authority, which is governed by relevant representatives from stakeholders of an economy. Because the money issuance is an aspect which affects anyone. Now, in the example of the very simple example of the person A, B, and C, if somebody were just to issue a note out of nowhere, all the three people would actually get really upset. So what you need to do is that when you talk about issuance of new money, it should not be just done by one authority or a few people. The relevant representatives of an economy, which is producers of goods and services, and the people involved and the buyers, they should have the representatives who can agree on when new money should be issued. Secondly, money has to be accounted for accurately and continuously. And that was what gold and silver used to achieve by the nature that they are existed. But they can now, this aspect does not have to be done by gold or silver. It can be done through computers. And computer digits can be stored pretty much forever. And as long as they're being done in an ethical way and the data can, just like any other electronic data, can be stored pretty much infinitely. And finally, and above all, the most important aspect of money issuance is that it needs to be issued on the basis of a very formal and established method that is linked to the amount of goods and services that the economy is able to produce and deliver. Now, this is the most important aspect, that your money issuance has to be linked to your ability to produce goods and services. As an example, you can link your new money issuance to new or enhanced GDP. GDP is a measure of the goods and services that an economy produces over a certain period of time. Now, these are extremely important concepts, negligence of which has created a lot of systemic flaws and ethical issues in our financial setup. Now, I would like you to remember these points, because really, unless and until these conditions are met in terms of money issuance, you will continue to run into the problems that we have seen and are continuing to see, because money, whether it's the pound or the dollar or any other currency, they continue to be issued without any formal basis. And therefore, it's not just a question of inflation and financial crisis. It opens a Pandora's box of a variety of other issues that we all continue to face in our economy. The discussion so far should enable us to understand the essence of the following three aspects, so that we're able to understand who should be responsible for issuance of money in an economy, how much new money should be issued at any point in time, and who should this money be given to. And if you were to go back and revisit the very simple example that we discussed earlier about within the three people, you can always make a decision of how these three aspects should be addressed. It's also extremely important, and I'll move on to the one basic slide, that now that we understand the true concept of money, we also need to understand interest in this context. You know, amongst other issues, a severe drawback of interest is that it encourages people to hold on to money and makes money into a commodity itself. You know, as we've just seen, money is really nothing but it's like a voucher. You know, it gives you the ability to buy something. And just to be able to earn money on just money itself through interest without actually having a transaction or a possible value addition or wealth creation, it can create significant distortions in the economy. And therefore, an interest-based system, what it really does is it discourages people to make an effort or to take a risk for participating in real economic activities of earning. And this can be a totally different topic, and I'm happy to talk about it in another webinar or another topic, but this is just to give you a quick flavor that money issuance without any basis combined with the aspect of interest really can create a lot of havoc, which we are all witnessing now. Another key systemic flaw in the system, which I'd like to just briefly touch on, which I mentioned in a very basic concept in one of the earlier slides, is what is fancily, in a very fancy term, known as an asset liability tenor mismatch. But what it really means is that you borrow short term and you lend long term. This is really the basic way all commercial banks earn money. Basically, all the banks take money from depositors with the promise of giving them an interest rate and with the understanding that all these depositors can really withdraw their money anytime. But what really happens is that on the other end, the same banks lend the money, the same money, for a longer period, for loans, mortgages, credit cards, etc., at a higher interest rates. And all this does is that there's a big bet which basically assumes that not more than a certain small percentage of depositors will want to withdraw their money at the same time. And really, that's really what happens when you see big banks collapsing overnight, and we have witnessed just a few in the last few years, but effectively if you go back into history, you will see that in the early part of the 20th century, there were thousands of banks that failed. And so, you know, these occurrences are not uncommon. I wouldn't be surprised if it happens again. But the point I'm trying to also make is that the depositors are also to blame. You know, either we don't know where are we getting returns from, or we don't really care. So if we know that the basic foundation of the system is this, then effectively, perhaps we can do all our bit as well to improve the system. Talking about the global financial crisis, I think now that we have some basis, and I know it's a very vast topic, and you know we don't have enough time to talk about it in much detail, but I've tried my best in the last half an hour basically give you the very basic sort of tools for you to learn further about this problem. But just I will make some quick points to clarify about the current global financial crisis. You know, now that you understood about the basic flaws in money issuance and other aspects, you will probably understand that the current crisis is really not surprising at all. But the real issue is that there seems to be no significant concentration on the root causes. So just to take you through the steps, you know, a lot of unnaturally created wealth is being created out of nowhere. It's being lent over and over again for earning interest, which raises the prices of assets artificially and therefore creates inflation. Because of easy availability of debt, people started living beyond their means, and this problem was more enhanced in mortgages given to those people who were not really creditworthy, which is fancily called subprime mortgages. And this was essentially done by certain financiers for very quick high returns because the subprime mortgages obviously attracted higher interest rates. Although these are separate topics, but derivatives and structured credit, and I will not have enough time to go into the details of those, but basically they further exacerbated the problem because through these fancy products, these mortgages were packaged and sold off over and over again all over the world. So eventually many of the borrowers of these mortgages and other products eventually defaulted. Any negative income stream problems, any loss of job, any decline in their income made them default. And eventually, when borrowers defaulted beyond a certain point, the whole system collapsed and the asset prices fell significantly. Approximately 45% of the global wealth was wiped out within 18 months. So borrowers default, because the borrowers default, there were bank failures. When bank failures happen, there's a credit crunch. You know, banks don't lend out enough credit. It makes a negative market sentiment. In this negative market sentiment, people stop buying goods and services or decline the sales. This results in job losses, and that further results in more defaults. And through this sort of vicious cycle, we experience what is a downward spiral, and that is really what we've witnessed in the last few years. It's important to remember that because of the system, you know, individuals and economies are somewhat really addicted to debt, because debt is something that the major economies in the world are trying to struggle with. They're unable to pay back even their interest, and therefore, unfortunately, the solution that most of the bigwigs in the economic world are trying to come up with is just not really a solution, but a very temporary relief by actually giving more debt. So they just to solve the problem temporarily, you pump in more money, and that really is not a solution. It's just like a morphine injection to a morphine patient, really. So these are important aspects which are to be remembered when we're talking about solutions to the crisis. The uncontrolled currency issuance, and so you know, there's a lot of socio-political issues that come up because of this uncontrolled currency issuance. The booms and busts that we face in our economic cycles that are not really natural. They happen because of these things, not a natural phenomena. And therefore, it's important to remember that when we have uncontrolled currency issuance, we have interest-based systems, we have debt as a major product to sell and addict everyone to debt, these problems occur because of it, not the other way around. To wrap up you know, the basic points that I've talked about in this presentation today. I'm going to repeat and just summarize what I've just talked about so far. And just to reiterate that this is some of the most important aspects. There are other aspects as well, and this can obviously be discussed in future webinars, but this is just to give you the very basics to understand the crisis, its problem, and its remedies. So yes, paper currency and its electronic equivalents do add significant convenience to the system, but they should only be a means of exchange of goods and services, and you have to have a very well-defined basis for their issuance, which is linked to actual wealth. An uncontrolled issuance of currency combined with an interest-based economy leads to major inflation and, above all, an unlimited supply of loans and credit. Therefore, it gives money lenders and currency issuers a continuous way to earn money, but unfortunately, it is at the expense of the general public and other unrelated organizations. Asset liability tenor mismatches, i.e. taking money from depositors at an interest and then lending money for longer periods, is a major way where financial institutions make money, but it really, really relies on a big bet as opposed to real value addition. There are a lot of speculative businesses that are going on. Again, we can talk about this at some future point, but effectively there's a lot of wealth, artificial wealth that gets created by simply playing around with the system that we have created as opposed to actual value addition. Central banks and banks are a very, very critical part of an economy, and the services they provide can add significant value, but some of the services that are being offered really are currently overshadowing some of the good elements as well. You know, economic growth and, you know, it's really controlled to interest rates these days. It's become like a norm, but I think that norm really needs to be seriously questioned. So to summarize some of the desirable aspects of what an ideal system should have as like a remedy to this problem is a summary of what I have explained to you earlier, but I will reiterate, is that paper currency and its electronic equivalents have to have a very well-defined basis for their issuance, which is linked to actual wealth and economic output. There can be various ways this can be achieved, and one of the ways I can suggest is if you can link your currency to either a predefined basket of goods and services or even simply your country's GDP. You don't have to have gold or silver. You don't have to go back to the gold standard. You simply need to have a basis linked to your production of goods and services or your GDP, and this basis has to be strictly audited. It's not supposed to be done by just a few people who do it when they feel like doing it, and it has to be done with the consensus of the representatives of the stakeholders. You know, we as a human race have evolved. We've come up with very sophisticated ways of managing companies with boards of directors and accountability. I'm not really, it's not really surprising we can do this for money issuance as well. And therefore, that will create discipline in the system, which will avoid the kind of crisis that we are simply looking at right now. All speculative businesses which rely on gain at the expense of somebody else's loss should really be prohibited. This is again a vast topic, but I think most of the people who are listening will understand that a lot of the even so-called legitimate financial transactions, whether it's derivatives, whether it's even foreign currency trading or spot equity trading, you know, a lot of them smell of gambling. You know, it's just literally you're trying to make money by playing with the system without really actually having any value addition at the other end. Rather than plain interest, earnings should be done through equity, rent, or trade in its true form. Again, this is a separate topic, but frankly, just the very simple concept of interest, lending money and getting more money on it without realizing what happens on the other side, plays a very significant role in distortions of the system. When you talk about investments, the asset liability tenor mismatches, which I talked about earlier, they have to be avoided, and depositors and investors have to be made aware of where their money is being invested. And they're just not getting a return out of nowhere. What is it that is getting them the return, and what are the risks they face with such investments? What is their flexibility of the ability to withdraw their investments without making bets? People who do not desire a return on the deposit, should their money should not be utilized without asking them for investments or loans. And therefore, all the deposits that you put in banks should theoretically be matched to their respective investments, and the investors should know where their money has been invested and what is it that's getting them the returns, and how easy or difficult it is for them to withdraw the money as opposed to just being kept in the dark. I've given you a graph in this next slide just to give you a very simplistic but very true situation of what it is like. Historically, you know, the booms and the busts in the system, this graph represents the growth and decline of an economy. As time is passing, our booms and busts are getting severer with each cycle, and every cycle is getting shorter with the time. And this is not really, it's not a coincidence, it's happening because of the fundamental flaws that I've discussed. And there may come a time when, you know, the collapse can just completely burst the system. And if we do implement an ethical system which has currency issued ethically, which has all the elements that I have somewhat talked about, you will have a system which will result in possibly slower but consistent growth, and we'll have a better income distribution. Income distribution is extremely lopsided right now. It's like, you know, literally 1% of the world owns like 99% of the wealth, and that is not a coincidence. The whole system is favoring the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer. And therefore, if an ethical system with the foundations that I've just mentioned is implemented, you will have consistent growth with better income distribution as opposed to booms and busts that benefit just a very privileged few. I'll conclude by giving you a couple of sayings from some famous people. And you know, Henry Kissinger really said it really, really, really well. He said, "Who controls the money controls the world." Very recently, just about 2 years back at the World Economic Forum, the chairman of the forum said that today we have reached a tipping point which leaves us with only one choice: change or face the continued decline and misery. So at every global forum, anybody who has some sense is trying to say the same things, that we have to make major change to some of the foundations of our system, otherwise we're going to continue to face the decline that the world has seen. So I hope this session has been useful to you. If there are any questions, I'll be more than happy to ask, and I leave the floor to Ali back and see if you have any questions about that.
Well, thank you, Mr. Qazi. Folks, if you have any questions, please feel free to raise your hand. There is a hand icon on your webinar console, so if you click on it, I will be able to moderate and give you an opportunity to ask them one by one. Okay, we have the hand raised from Mr. Hamza Bilal. So let me try to unmute you. Mr. Bilal, can you hear us? Hello? Mr. Hamza Bilal, can you hear us? Hamza, I believe there is a mash in the background, so I believe you've also posted your question in the comment chat box, so let me read it for you. Just a second. Mr. Hamza Bilal has posted the question. Let me read it for you, Mr. Qazi.
Sure.
He's written, if the currency was still backed by gold or silver, what would countries having smaller gold reservoirs do? Plus, markets having natural gold reserves would always have stronger currency regardless of the real economic indicators.
Sure. I think that's a very valid question, and I will just repeat what I already mentioned in the presentation, that it's absolutely true that if the countries that do not have sufficient reserves of gold or silver, they will be at a disadvantage, which is why I reiterated in this presentation that you don't have to have gold or silver as a standard. There was a reason why gold and silver was made a standard. It had an advantage. It had some discipline associated with it, which controlled for a certain amount. But it's true, as the production of goods and services, as the economies grow, the supply of gold or silver may not be able to keep up with it, which is why, as of today, my solution is not really to go back to the gold standard. That is something that was given away, but my point is you have to have a standard. It doesn't have to be gold and silver. It has to be linked to the production of goods and services that an economy can undertake. And that can be either you can link your issuance of currency to a basket of goods and services that your country produces, or you can simply link it to your GDP. But at the end of the day, you have to have a formal basis which economists can sit down and decide what is most appropriate for their country, declare the basis, and any new currency that is issued is done on that basis with the supervision and permission and consensus of the stakeholders, as opposed to just issuing it at the time when you need to meet your deficits. That's what happens right now. Every time a government has a deficit, they just print more money. And if they're unable to pay some of their old debts, they just print more money to pay back their old debt. Right? It's a vicious cycle that we're all seeing, which is heading towards a disaster. I mean, you look at what's happening in the Eurozone, and every new month you see a different country coming up with a debt crisis, be it Greece or Italy or whoever. And the reason is the same. You're just simply issuing more money to pay back your old debt. So this could have been avoided if you actually had a formal basis which was more linked towards production of goods and services. You must not forget that every note of currency that you hold in your hand is a promise that you can buy something from that piece of paper. And if there isn't enough goods and services behind the economy that can deliver on all those pieces of paper, then you have a problem. And therefore, that's how unnationalization occurs. I hope I have clarified that aspect.
Oh, well, I think you also have the supplementary question, which let me read it for you also. He wrote, the speaker emphasizes the valuation of currency based on real economic indicators, such as GDP. Does forex rate fluctuation not automate the same?
No. Actually, if you look at it, it's a very valid point, but what really happens is there's another thing I briefly hinted on, which is speculative. You would realize, if you look at the numbers, and I've done a lot of research on this, at the moment, it's really shocking to know that only 2% of the global spot foreign exchange transactions happen because there is a reason for buying that particular currency. So if you want to buy dollars based on another currency, the normal reason is that you need to buy something from that economy, not just because you're buying it to hoard it so that its value goes up and you can sell it to more money on a speculative basis. So shockingly speaking, only 2% of the global foreign exchange spot transactions currently happen because there's a reason to actually buy in good services against that foreign currency. The remaining 98% of the transactions are currently happening purely for speculation, purely to make a quick gain within a short period of time. So that in itself is a problem. So therefore, frankly, the linkage to the actual production of goods and services may happen to a certain extent. Frankly, it's very easy because you don't have a formal basis. It gets very distorted, and the issuance of money without a formal basis really makes things very lopsided. It's not just only a question of issuing the money without a basis, but then once you issue it, who do you give it to? You know, do you give it to back to the banks to lend it for reasons that may or may not be value added? That's yet another problem, right? So it is an interconnected problem, and therefore perhaps just the ethical issuance of money will not solve the problem. These are other aspects that we have touched upon. But if you start from that aspect, I think a lot of the other things will fall in place.
Thank you. I think Hamza, if you have any further questions or if you are in supplementary, please feel free to throw it in the chat box. Meanwhile, I'll move on to the next questions. We have Mr. Muhammad Arif al-Islam, who has written that, unfortunately he doesn't have a mic, but he's only into the listening mode. He wrote, I was wondering how the currency impacts the economy when the currency is fixed for a purchase in between third countries. Example, exchange between Dubai and Iraq. Price is quoted on USD compared to price is on local current.
Sorry, Ali, could you repeat this? I kind of missed out. I lost you in the middle.
This question was from Muhammad Arif al-Islam, who has written, I was wondering how the currency impacts the economy when the currency is fixed for a purchase in between third countries. The example he has mentioned is an exchange between Dubai and Iraq. Price is quoted on USD compared to price is on local currency.
Okay, perfect. Very valid question. There are lots of currencies in the world, especially in the Middle East and GCC, which are pegged to another currency, like especially the US dollar. You know, the Saudi Riyal, the Emirati Dirham, and many other currencies are pegged. Now what happens is, when you peg your currency to some other currency, it really in effect becomes that currency. So in many ways, if the Riyal or the Dirham is pegged to the dollar, you have to follow the same regime. So if dollars are being issued in exchange to keep the same exchange rate, you have to follow the same rules for money supply and issuance. And therefore, if the US dollar is the common currency to which it is pegged, then in many ways the economies which are pegging their currency to that US dollar are becoming in certain way part of the US economy, because any goods and services that these small economies are producing can be effectively considered as being bought by the same currency. So effectively it's a big, what you call, autonomy that you're giving up, because you are not linking your currency to the production of your goods and services, but you're handing it over as part of a bigger economic zone. And that may be useful at the time when a particular economy isn't really on its own feet and it is not confident that its currency will be accepted in the world and it doesn't have a value. Therefore, just to kind of ride on somebody else's back, you kind of peg it. But as and when economies grow and they have a sufficient amount of goods and services, especially Saudi Arabia, which have their own oil and stuff, you know, it's a big political question, because theoretically maybe they should not be pegged, but then it becomes a political problem. And you have seen other currencies like Kuwaiti dinar, you will see, is not really pegged to the dollar, it's against a basket of currencies. A lot of the talk in the world is now happening about having another, you know, a global unit of exchange as opposed to the dollar, maybe a basket of currencies. You know, China is in a similar problem, so they might have just seen today they've done a deal with Japan where they're kind of going to have to buy each other's goods and services through each other's currencies and so on and so forth. So the pegging of any country's currency to another currency has an impact in terms of giving up the autonomy. And you basically, if the currency to which it is pegged does well, you also do well. But if it goes down, regardless of how good your own economy is, you will also do well.
Thank you, Mr. Qazi. Folks, I've noticed a lot of you have started posting questions in the chat box, but feel free to raise your hand because I can give you the opportunity to ask him directly. Let me try to unmute Dorothy McClair. Dorothy, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, Dorothy, we can. So could you please, I understand that you've written the question, so could you feel free to ask him, Mr. Qazi, directly.
Yes, first, thanks so much
and
for the opportunity.
And also, please introduce where you're from and where you're calling from.
Sure. I'm calling from New York City, and I'm a business school professor here in the United States. And my question relates to the statements and charts about normal income distribution, where it's discussed that this is a more ethical system. So my question is, can we infer that capitalism is unethical because the risk of capitalism contributes to income distribution that isn't normal? And if it's not, what is the point where we have an ethical system, but we don't take away that risk-reward scenario that capitalism has?
Okay, thank you very much. Very, very good question. I think that's a much bigger topic. When you talk about capitalism, there's a lot of different aspects that come into play. All I'm saying is, when you talk about income distribution, I know the chart that I very simplistic, and it was just to demonstrate a particular point. The way it's going on right now, it's not that capitalism itself is the problem, and you know, capitalism, whenever you do it, is going to actually end up resulting in this. I think the, of course, income distribution will never be equal exactly, but you know, there has to be a trend. When you talk about the basic points that I talked about today, which is money issuance and you know and other distorted forms and how we do it, it exacerbates the problem. So continuously, money continues to go into smaller number of hands, and that's what I'm talking about. I think I'm quite convinced that, of course, nothing can be perfect, but if you do adopt a system which at least conforms to some of the basic ethics. I mean, capitalism never says that you should have money issued out of nowhere, right? It's not part of capitalism. That is basic common sense, that you have to have money issued by monetary authority, by some basis which makes sense and links to the production of goods and services as opposed to unilateral decisions. So that's what I'm saying. It's a much longer topic, but I would say that the violation of some very basic principles that is not really part of capitalism. It's a misuse of a certain aspect. So yes, if you were to not violate those basic principles, then it would be a much better system. There are obviously other aspects as well, and not everybody would become rich, but the continuous trend of the income distribution getting worse and worse, and I have a lot of other statistics which I can share at a later point, how in pretty much every country, it's not just the underdeveloped countries, it's even most developed countries like the United States, that the income distribution is getting worse and worse. So I don't want to get into the like, real big debate between capitalism or other forms of system, but all I'm saying is that we need to just concentrate on the very basic ethical concepts.
Thank you very much.
Well, pleasure.
Thank you, Dorothy. Are really short of the time, so I will move on to the next question quickly from Mr. Bilal, Muhammad Bilal Rashid. Mr. Bilal, I think you have posted it on the chat box also, so let me read it from there. Let me try to meet you again. Just a second. The question from Mr. Bilal was, what do you foresee with the coming financial euro crisis and how it correlates with the issuance of money?
Thank you. I think I touched upon it very briefly, but I think, frankly, I've also learned that I never like to make very sort of predictive or futuristic statements, because only God knows what's going to really happen and you know, things may get improved. But what I want to say is that when you talk about prediction about what's going to happen in any country, whether it's a global crisis or something else, all you should be able to do is why did the crisis happen in the first place, and if the fundamental reasons why the crisis happened have still not been addressed or not been improved, then perhaps it's an answer that things are not really going to improve. Now, what has happened is the various European countries which have reached this stage, I think you can infer from the discussion today that it just didn't happen out of nowhere. It happened because, of a fundamental issue of having your expenses more than your revenues, having to fund those excessive expenses, which are more than revenues, from incremental debt, and then using more debt to pay back the previous debt. It's as simple as that. And, you know, you eventually reach a point where you are unable to pay your previous debt for more debt because your credibility is going down. It's like a vicious cycle. It's a very standard basic problem of living beyond your means, not having the right sources to earn more, to cope up, overspending, and then having more money printed either through debt or otherwise to sort of solve the problem very temporarily. And therefore, the very common debate that you continue to see on TV and otherwise is whether they should, with somebody or the other, should bail them out. By bailing them out, it simply means that they print more money or not. Right? So it's a catch-22 situation. So yes, I think that the fundamental causes and flaws that I've talked about have played an extremely important role in them reaching this stage. Now, whether the solution lies in actually printing more money or not, or you know, it's really it's a difficult and tough choice. But the point is, I will reiterate that I think that yes, there may be some temporary solutions that might come out to temporarily avert the problems by maybe the Eurozone bailing them out by the same what is very pleasantly called quantitative easing, but it's not going to solve the problem. And eventually, I think CyberSafe will say, even if there isn't like a major default by or an actual default by any of the countries, at least inflation is on the cards, right? So you're going to see inflation happen across the globe, whether now or later, because it's just going to be mathematically so. So that's my sort of two-bit on that question, that yes, I don't see the problem being resolved that simply. Will not be surprised at all if you see a couple of the countries actually defaulting and causing a bit of a stir, to say the least. And if not that, at least if there is, there are more bailouts by money printing, then obviously you will see inflation down the road, which is going to further cause problems in terms of other socioeconomic issues.
Okay. We are really running out of time, but let me just take on this interesting question again from Hamza, which he's written. For any economic system, having interest, inflation is inherent. With inflation comes need for more currency. Is floating currency issuance a cause or an effect?
Okay, I think from what I understood from the question is that what Hamza is trying to say is that when you have an interest-based system, you know, the inflation is going to be automatic, and therefore, because of the interest-based system, you know, the currency issuance, you know, is it the other way around? I think it's a very valid question, and it's kind of with the chicken and egg situation that I have mentioned initially in the presentation that it is a lethal combination. First of all, if you have money being issued out of nowhere, or not having a formal basis, on top of it, to combine it with the concept of interest, it really it becomes a case of a downward spiral. Now, whether the interest-based system is the cause for more issuance or not, difficult to say, but yes, even though it's a much longer debate, and I don't think I'll be able to answer this right now, but my personal view is that yes, if you were to hypothetically remove interest as a concept from the system and link it and have the earning on the money basically on actual value addition either through rent, equity or trade, yes, you will be able to resolve the problem of the money issuance to a great extent as well. Because currently, you must not forget that because money is issued out of nowhere, there's an incentive to issue more money because the money issuers can earn interest on that same money. Right, so it is ridiculous in some ways that you issue something out of nowhere and then start earning money. So to a certain extent, yes, if you were to hypothetically remove interest from the system and have other ways of earning wealth, which are still there but not exclusive, you would be able to theoretically resolve the problem to a great extent. And I have actually a full-fledged discussion on this topic, and I'm happy to present this at perhaps another webinar. About the whole concept of interest versus other methods. And, you know, it's not something that people might think that I'm alluding to, you know, turning into an Islamic banking system. The Islamic banking system has its own fundamental problems right now in terms of its implementation, but the concepts are very good. And we can have another discussion, which I have a full list of bullet points of what the benefits are of the interest-based system and what the disadvantages are. In my opinion, disadvantages are far more, and whereas it might sound very basic at this point, you know, that how can you have a system without interest, but honestly, the kind of distortions and the problems the simple concept of interest has, especially against the backdrop of the concept of money that we taught, it really is one of the root causes, and therefore, I would think that there is a reason why it's equivalent in our Arabic or Christian world, like riba, or usury, was so severely from. frowned upon because it creates a Pandora's box of issues which are very, very difficult to solve once it becomes part of the system. So very, very valid question.
Well, that really brings it towards the end of our webinar, and because of the we're running out of the time, so I would like to thank Mr. Shahid Qazi on behalf of MAHIL for your time and willingness to share your valuable information and experiences with our participants. Folks, if you have any other questions, we would be, let me tell you, we would be uploading this, the recorded version of the webinar on our website, especially on our blog, so feel free to visit it later and we shall be sending you the email with the link. We will also be emailing you an evaluation form, so please take a couple of minutes to fill it out. It will give us an opportunity to review it and come up with more webinars based on your interest in the future. Once again, Mr. Qazi, thank you very much for your time and everybody who participated today, and we would like to thank everyone, each one of you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and it was a pleasure.
And we will be ending the webinar, so everybody will be automatically dismissed out. Thank you very much.
Thank you.